the narrow impact of programs on the individual earnings may not be sufficient for the program to be cost effective. We really need to design programs in a way to maximize the externalities that they may create related to effects on psychosocial well-being, on social cohesion, on youth engagement in risky behavior.
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. Does workfare work? Well, there are certainly a lot of programs in low-income countries, but how much do we know about what they achieve in both the short and the long term for the people who take part? An analysis of one program in Côte d'Ivoire fills in some of the gaps in our knowledge. Patrick Premond of the Development Impact Evaluation Group at the World Bank is one of the researchers, and he joins me now. Patrick, welcome to Vox Dev Talks.
Hello, team. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's great to have you, Patrick. Tell me, first of all, how common are these public works programs? We know them as workfare in low-income countries. What sort of work do they tend to provide?
So public works are one of the most common instruments to provide social assistance in low-income countries. They may not be as common as cash transfers, but they're still very popular among policymakers. You know, billions of dollars of funding have been allocated to these programs. And before the COVID crisis, some of my colleagues at the World Bank Social Protection Sector has estimated that around 60 developing countries were implementing some kind of workfare programs. Now, the workfare programs typically provide cash to help raise participants' earnings and support their consumption. The cash is given as a wage, so in exchange of participants working on the provision of some sort of public goods, and those jobs can last for a few days or months during the year. Now, in practice, you know, the work can take many different forms. It can involve cleaning roads, building some small infrastructure, planting trees, and so on. Public works have been used as a social protection tool to provide relief from economic shocks or crises. You can think of financial crisis in the early 2000s in Argentina. Various countries in Africa are using public works as a part of their response to climatic shocks or conflict shocks. Some of the largest programs in Ethiopia or India provide work opportunity during the agricultural off seasons. But I think what's interesting is that these programs are increasingly being used as part of employment policy with longer term objectives to open pathways to more productive employment after the program. And so this is done by adding training components, by adding opportunities to save, by adding micro-entrepreneurship support to these basic workfare components.
One of the things I was interested in, I picked this up from your paper, is that many economists, they argue that workfare is better targeted than traditional welfare programs. Why is that?
When policymakers design traditional welfare programs like cash transfers, they need to define processes to target the poorest households that would be eligible. And in developing countries, there's really limited administrative data. So, you know, means testing is often impossible. Instead, targeting has to rely on other methods such as proxy means test or community-based targeting. And, you know, the performance and legitimacy of these targeting methods has varied quite a bit. Now, with workfare program, one appealing idea is that you can use self-targeting. In other words, you know, participants have to work and provide efforts to get the cash. So, you know, the idea is that if you set the wage relatively low, then only people who really need the transfer will come forward. This sounds appealing, but it's actually not that fully clear cut that this can be effective in low-income settings. So if, for instance, if you take most of sub-Saharan Africa, there are still relatively few wage jobs. You know, close to 85% of people are self-employed, either in agriculture or in the informal economy. So in that sense, there are many more underemployed individuals that earn relatively little in informal occupations than they are fully idle or unemployed individuals that do nothing. So this means that when you run a public works program in a low-income setting, many participants are likely to forego some earnings from these other occupations when they join. So even if you set a low wage, you'll attract a mix of participants. Some of them may earn nothing absent the program, so for them, impact would be high. But some of them may have earned just below the program wage. They still find it beneficial to join, but the impact for them is going to be lower. And so, you know, whether self-targeting is effective really depends on the distribution of earnings that people have outside the program. And this is very much something that may, you know, vary across contexts and settings.
And do the benefits include some kind of training or some kind of way into the formal economy? Or are they really just about work for money?
So I think it depends. So the modalities of those programs really vary. Some programs ask participants to, you know, sign a formal employment contract. So then they hold these formal wage jobs for, you know, a few weeks or months. But this is not always the case. You know, some of the programs have participants just register as they would register for any other social assistance program. Either way, the jobs tend to be quite low skilled. They can be done easily without much training or just a little training on how to operate tools, safety procedures, and so on. But as I mentioned before, you know, some programs do have longer term objectives to improve employment opportunities. And in those programs, often additional training is provided. So it's not training for the skills that you need to do the public works jobs, but it's training to equip participants with, you know, additional skills that may help them transition into more productive jobs or businesses after their participation in the program. So this can include life skills training, micro-entrepreneurship training to operate small businesses, or how to search for job skills, preparing CVs and things like that.
I asked the question in the introduction, how much do we know about how well these programs work? So I'll ask it again, how much do we know? What do we need to find out?
Well, you know, I would say that the body of knowledge on public works is a little thinner than the evidence we have on cash transfer programs, but it's still substantial and growing quite fast. I mentioned earlier that the India and Ethiopia public works program are some of the largest in the world, and they have generated quite a lot of attention. Studies have aimed to understand, you know, the poverty profile of participants and the incidence of the program benefits on participants. And we have seen results showing that participants do forego earnings when they participate in workfare programs, but there are also positive effects that have been documented rather consistently on earnings and consumption, at least in the short term. Another set of studies has focused on the productive impacts of public works on participants' assets and investments, again, finding positive effects on investment in agriculture or small businesses, at least in the short to medium term, though there the results vary quite a bit across studies. Lastly, there's some more recent work that has suggested important externalities from those programs in terms of effects on market wages, on risky behaviors related to engagement in violence, or in India, for instance, or on local amenities in urban Ethiopia. So there is a body of evidence that is substantial and growing, but still some important gaps. First, as I mentioned before, a growing number of programs have both short and long-term objectives, and I think we still need to better understand how public works can have impacts that are sustained over time, and whether there are trade-offs between the short-term objectives and those longer-term objectives. A second aspect relates to how to optimize targeting. In some ways, this is an old question, but as we discussed earlier, but we have new tools to look into this now, including machine learning techniques that we have tried to apply in our study to push this analysis of targeting further. Thirdly, the effects of public works on psychosocial well-being, social cohesion, and risky behaviors have not been documented very consistently yet. There's a few studies that have done that, but still this is an area where I think we need more. And lastly, maybe something we can return to later, I think the value of the public goods that are created by public works has not received as much attention, even though it may actually be essential for the overall cost effectiveness of those programs.
We have a lot to talk about, don't we? So let's get into it. Let's have a look at this program that you've written about in the paper. It was created by the government of Cote d'Ivoire in 2010 using an emergency loan from the World Bank. So what was the emergency?
Cote d'Ivoire was one of the countries in sub-Saharan Africa with the highest standards of living in the 90s, but then suffered from a period of conflict in the mid-2000s. And the latest setback came in 2010-2011 when a crisis erupted after the results of a presidential election were contested. And that post-electoral crisis induced several months of violence before a new government came in. Ah. So after that, we worked on the evaluation of a series of youth employment programs that were set up right after this post-electoral crisis, and that included the public works that we are discussing today, among other things. What's also interesting is that the workfare programs had already been used in Cote d'Ivoire during the crisis and conflict years. And during the post-crisis period, the public works had both this short-term objective of providing immediate relief and creating temporary jobs for youth, but also to improve employment opportunities over the longer term. And so as such, it really tried to provide a bridge from those crisis years into post-crisis recovery and longer-term development aspirations that the country had at the time.
So for the people who took part in this program, what did their participation involve? How many were there as well?
So the key aspect was really the provision of temporary jobs for 6 months that were targeted to low-skilled youth between 18 and 13 years old in 16 urban localities across Cote d'Ivoire. Participants signed an employment contract. They worked for 6 hours per day, about 5 days a week for 6 months. And the jobs were paid approximately $5 a day, which is the equivalent of the legal minimum wage in Côte d'Ivoire. Those wages were paid monthly on bank accounts that were set up as part of the program. And participants worked in teams. They were put in groups of about 25 and together were working on road maintenance, sweeping roads, cleaning ditches. And all of this was supervised by the National Roads Agency.
Mm-hmm.
Beside those temporary jobs, some participants were offered training on micro-entrepreneurship. So the idea was to help them operate more productive small businesses after their exit from the program. And some other participants were offered the training on how to search for wage jobs. Here, the objective was to help them find better wage employment opportunities after they left the program as well. Overall, during the phase we study, about 13,000 youth participated.
Gosh.
The program expanded further a little later. It's still not reaching by far all youth in the country. This is still limited scale. But, you know, it's kind of a substantial program that was run by the government at the time.
It is a very large program. But how can you evaluate its impact? As you say, there are a lot of possible impacts that it could have. Also, there's self-selection into the program. That must make it difficult.
Yes, Tim. So here we designed a randomized control trial that entirely rely on public lotteries that had been used by program implementers, you know, for several years before we arrived to collaborate with them. You know, specifically, when the government launched the program, it organized a communication campaign to advertise it. And as you say, interested youth self-select and came to apply. Once all applicants had signed up, they were invited to a public ceremony where each of them would draw a number out of a bucket. And those with the lowest numbers were selected to join the program.
Oh.
And what is, I think, extremely interesting here is that those public lotteries were used well before we came to evaluate the program. And in fact, they were put in place during the conflict years in Côte d'Ivoire when an earlier version of the program operated. And the public lottery were seen as the most transparent way to allocate limited spots in the program without creating tension. And so, you know, basically every single person applying had the same chance of getting the job. From the evaluation standpoint, this is an ideal scenario in the sense that those lotteries create a group of participants and a control group of non-participants that are similar, and the two can be compared over time to isolate the impact of the program. One thing we added in collaboration with the government team was another step to assign two lotteries, a third of participants to receive additional micro-entrepreneurship training and another third to receive additional job search training. And there the motivation was to assess whether there was any value added from those training and whether they should later be extended to more youth into the program. So we basically have four groups. We have a control group that did not get the program. We have a group that just got the public works. We have a group that got the public works plus the micro-entrepreneurship training. And then we have a group that received the public works plus the wage employment trainings. And we surveyed them before the program, 4 months into the program, and then a year after the program to assess how to compare outcomes between these various groups over time.
You must have a lot of results from this. So first of all, most important, did the program increase savings and employment?
Yes, Tim. So the primary objective of the program was related to employment. And we do find that it did increase the likelihood that youth were working, but not by that much, only by about 14 percentage points. And this is because 85% of youth in the control group were engaged in some sort of activity, mostly in the informal sector, as I mentioned earlier. So the program, however, had a much stronger impact on the type of work that youth were doing. There was a large increase in the share of youth that were holding wage jobs by 48 percentage points. So it means a lot of young people actually left other types of jobs to get into wage jobs. And in particular, we see a decrease in the share of youth that are in self-employment. So all of this highlights that youth are basically reorganizing the type of activities that they do in order to join the program. Related to that, the public works program led to significant increases in earnings. To give you an idea, the net impact on earnings were strong at about $55 per month.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, this represented approximately half of the average transfers or wages that youth received. So this means that in absence of the program, on average, youth would have earned about 50% less than what they earned during the program. And again, we see these patterns where, of course, the earnings from wage employment go up, but the earnings from self-employment go down as, you know, people reshuffle the type of work that they do. Now, in relation to savings, like we do see that this increases earnings contribute to increased expenditures, including for youth themselves, for their family and basic necessities and so on. But we also do see that a good share of the impact on earning, maybe a little over a third, used to save. So we do see pretty substantial increases in saving stocks.
Well, that's money and employment, but what about those social outcomes? Did the people who were on these programs change their behavior? Did it improve their well-being?
In the short term, we do see improvements in a range of non-monetary dimensions of well-being, also in relations to behaviors and what could be seen as work habits. Hmm. So for instance, in terms of well-being, we collected a range of measures and we see that, you know, participants were more likely to report feeling happy and proud, had higher self-esteem, and more positive attitudes towards the future. You know, these may be driven by the economic impact, but we see that also for some youth that have a lower impact on earnings, we see those relatively large effects on well-being. So it seems quite important. The program also induced improvements in behaviors with reductions in measures of impulsiveness or anger. And this is interesting, but we did not see changes in other measures of youth engagement in risky behavior, such as, you know, taking drugs or smuggling. Though, of course, these are very hard to observe. So take this with a grain of salt. And the last thing is that we really saw youth change their work habits and reorganize their day. We see them consistently getting up much earlier and going to work and going to bed much earlier as well. So really kind of reshuffling a little bit their days for a few months at least.
We've had similar conversations about different programs of VoxDev Talks before, and one of the biggest challenges is to take improvements in the short term and make them last in the long term. So what happened to these short-term changes? Did they last?
The effects that we see 12 months after the program were much, much more muted. So we did not see impact on the likelihood of youth being employed or the types of occupations that they had a year after the program. And this is despite the really strong changes in the short term. And it's quite striking. We also did not see robust changes in earnings. Some ways to look at the data suggest effects on earnings up to 10% a year after the end of the program. So some people have argued that this should not be neglected, but it's also not fully robust to the way we look at the data. So we interpret that as still kind of limited effects on earning. At most, I think we see suggestive evidence that there is an increase in earnings in self-employment that may be associated with micro businesses having more assets and having benefited from more investments. But again, this remains quite limited. We did pick up some sustained impact on savings and psychological well-being, though it's much, much lower than during the program. And lastly, you know, another thing I should note is that we did not see much variation in impact after the program, depending on whether youth receive additional training or not during the public works. Oh. So overall, this training seems to have had a relatively limited value added.
That must be disappointing for you and for the people who are running the program, considering that short-term success. Why did these benefits disappear?
Yeah, so one explanation is that people quickly went back to the same type of occupations that they had before the program.
Well, yes.
So we see the same share of young people holding wage jobs, the same share of young people being self-employed. And it looks like this actually happened really quickly after the end of the program. So on the one hand, you could be worried that, you know, spending 6 months in this program will make it hard to regain the workforce and, you know, find occupations again. But we don't see that at all. We don't see any scarring at all. We see very much young people going back to this earlier occupations very quickly. But of course, on the other side, as you highlighted, it also means that the improvement in terms of employment outcomes after the program are not very strong at all. Now, the other thing is that, as I just mentioned, the training added to the public works did not have a lot of value added. But the nuance here is that the training did improve knowledge and skills. So we do see that young people that went to the micro entrepreneurship training have slightly better business skills. We do see that people that went to the job search training have better knowledge on how to search for jobs. And we do see young people developing business plans and preparing CVs. So we do see kind of some action coming out of that training. But the effects are not very large. And this is clearly insufficient to change the type of occupation that youth get into, and also clearly insufficient to affect earnings. And so in a way, I think the one reason for the lack of long-term impact is that, you know, those additional training had relatively limited added value.
What's the test for whether a program like this does represent good value? And in this case, is it passing or failing that test?
So the first thing we did was to conduct a fairly simple cost-benefit analysis, whereby we assess how the effects on earnings for youth add up over time, so both during and after the program, and how this compares to the cost of the program, including both the transfer, but also the indirect cost of managing and delivering this program. And so the first thing to note is that, as I mentioned before, like while the impact on earnings during the program are significant and positive, they are still much lower than the amount of the transfer. And so the impact on earnings for a given youth is about 50% of the amount of the money they receive. So this just gives you an indication in terms of cost effectiveness, in terms of how the benefits compare to the cost. And after the program, as I mentioned before, the increase in earnings was quite limited. So when we sum all of this together, we do see that the cost of the program are much higher than the benefits in terms of impact on earnings for youth, and roughly by a factor of 3. Another way to look at this is that the long-term impact, the post-program impact of the program will need to be sustained for many years, 4 to 6 years, for those effects on earnings to become larger than cost. So this suggests that, again, just looking at impact on youth earnings alone, the program is not cost effective. Now, another way to look at this, though, is to see, is there ways to improve cost effectiveness by identifying those youth that benefit the most and retarget the program to them? And there we do see, when we apply machine learning techniques, we do see that there's subgroups of youth that benefit much more than others during the program. And this relates to our discussion on self-targeting, that some people benefit more than others. Mm-hmm. And so we see that, you know, you could improve cost effectiveness if you're able to retarget to specific subgroups that are the poorest, to women also, that for whom impact are much larger than men. But even if you do that, it's probably not enough to pass a cost-benefit analysis. One big caveat with all of this is that we do not factor in the psychosocial dimensions and psychosocial well-being that are not, you know, counted as part of the earnings. And also, we do not account for potential externalities in terms of the value of the road maintenance and the value of the public goods that are provided. So in many ways, you could think of this as a conservative test that the program does not pass, but that, you know, depending on the externalities that are generated, may look a little bit better. Now, overall, you know, our assessment is that those externalities will need to be way too large for the program to be cost effective as is. And so you need to think of reducing cost and improving effectiveness to make it a better deal.
It shows how challenging it is to deliver a program like this. So what can we learn about how we improve workfare? Could we even question whether all these workfare programs are a worthwhile use of the money that they cost?
So yeah, I think our first takeaway is really related to the self-targeting. I think we tend to assume that, you know, workfare has high potential because it can rely on self-targeting. I think what we show, at least in our context, is that we do find that impact would be much stronger if we were able to target the poorest through proxy means test, other types of targeting approaches, through prioritizing women and so on. And this is because, again, the self-targeting attracts a lot of individuals that have, you know, non-zero and sometimes substantial earnings outside of the program. And we also show that even lowering the wage would not improve that. So I think one takeaway is that we really need to think carefully about the self-targeting and see to what extent that needs to be combined with other approaches to target the poorest populations for those types of programs. The second takeaway, I think, is that the jury is really still out on how to design workfare programs that can have impact beyond the short term. In our context, we do not find many long-term impacts. And I think overall, the evidence on this is still limited. So, you know, if policymakers have objective to improve long-term outcomes through those programs, then I think that we need to take a very close look at how to achieve that. And maybe the third takeaway is that, in a way, the narrow impact of programs on the individual earnings may not be sufficient for the program to be cost effective. We really need to design programs in a way to maximize the externalities that they may create related to effects on psychosocial well-being, on social cohesion, on youth engagement in risky behavior. In our context, we don't see those being very strong. I mean, there, some of it is there, but it's not extremely strong. But it may be different in high violence context or for specific populations that face particular social constraints like refugees and so on. Another externality relates to the public goods, the assets or infrastructures that are created by the programs. You know, in some contexts, public works are used to promote reforestation, to create water points, or for other environmental benefits, which may have a high value. But whether public works are worth it or not may depend ultimately on finding those public goods that have the highest returns and design public works really thinking carefully about this. What's important here is that we just can't assume that the externalities are sufficient and large enough for the program to be worthwhile, but really think about designing those programs with a way of maximizing those broader benefits, whether environmental or social. As we do that, I think we also need to then also shift the way we evaluate those programs to also document more the value of this public good generation. I think the good news here is that there's quite a bit of ongoing work in this space. For instance, in urban Ethiopia right now, we also have a collaboration, for instance, with the World Food Program. We are trying to document the environmental benefits from those type of programs. So, you know, hopefully we'll see some results on this in coming years. And I don't think it's time to say we need to pull the plug just yet.
No, I don't think so. Some very nuanced and I suspect very important conclusions from this research. Patrick, thank you very much.
Thank you, Tim. It was really a pleasure to be with you on the podcast.
The paper is called Do Workfare Programs Live Up to Their Promises? Experimental Evidence from Côte d'Ivoire. And the authors are Marianne Bertrand, Bruno Crépon, Alicia Marguerite, and Patrick Prémond. This has been a Vox Dev Talk. The best way to make sure you don't miss an episode is to subscribe on your podcast platform. Delighted to see so many more of you subscribing. And we've had some terrific guests, so if you feel inspired, leave us a review as well. But remember, you can also find the latest episodes plus articles about the papers that we featured at voxdev.org.